My fifth fortress.
Yeah, good. Okay, so as with Adam's previous talk, this talk has sort of two parts. One is that I was asked to talk a little bit about dark forces, and so I will introduce that and actually talk not just about dark forces, but more generally fifth forces. And then second of all is to highlight the role of nuclear physics in possibly probing these, and in particular some what I consider very interesting experimental and possibly theoretical work on that. So let's start at the beginning. We know of four fundamental forces. There they are. The fifth one would be a very big deal. Now, forces can, of course, be mediated by a host of particles. And we have, you know, we can talk about the pions mediating a strong force. We can talk about a Higgs-mediated force. People have looked for dilaton-mediated forces, long-range forces, things generated by large extra dimensions, towers of KK gravitons, and things like that. Just to be completely clear, that's a huge topic. I am going to, in this talk, define fifth force to be a force mediated by a new spin 1 gauge boson. Okay, so let's just be clear on that. Now, obviously, looking for fifth force is just a good thing to do for the simple possibility that it could be there, right? But there are actually motivations from very, very outstanding problems in our field, which I would like to just mention. In particular, I would mention two. One is unification, and the second one is dark matter. So let me just say the first one about unification. The quantum numbers of the Standard Model particles are, of course, known very well, but very strange. I've listed them here in a format too small for you to read, but you all know what they are. We have some particular color quantum numbers, weak quantum numbers, and even weirder hypercharges. And if you, however, think that these are all unified into a group like SO10, then the 16 particles of a single generation beautifully fill out a representation of SO10 in this way. The unification, of course, is also further motivated by the fact that, just very roughly, if you take the coupling constants of the SU3 across SU2 across U1 gauge loops, run them up, they kind of get closer. Whether they meet exactly or not is sort of one of the motivations for supersymmetry versus non-supersymmetry. But the fact that they get closer, and not just that, there's a non-trivial fact that they have to end up in a box. This has to end up at a perturbative level for the alphas, otherwise the whole running makes no sense. It shouldn't go meeting above the Planck mass, otherwise, again, it's in a region where we don't trust it. It shouldn't be too low, or else you would have proton decay. The fact that they kind of meet up here in this little box here, at least if you fuzz your eyes out a little bit, is, I think, also important, and we shouldn't forget that. So I would say that unification, despite all the facts that the LHC hasn't seen anything and maybe called supersymmetry and naturalness into question, is still an incredible hint that there should be some new physics out there. And the point for this talk is that any gut group, SO10 or bigger, so E6, E8, anything like that, has rank bigger than 4. And therefore, when you break it down to the Standard Model, there will be other pieces left over. Okay? So for example, SO10, it doesn't just break the SU3 across SU2 across U1. There's also some other piece, which could be a U1 B minus L or something. And that is a fifth force. Okay? That motivates just general phenomenology of a B minus L force, also called Z prime gauge bosons in a more general setting. And of course, we don't know exactly what mass level they're at. That's an open question. But the fact that there should be another force out there really, I think, is strongly motivated by just these simple arguments. Okay, how about dark matter? Oh, and I should say that I have prepared a talk which is designed to go in the 30-minute limit, but it'd be far better if you actually interrupted and sort of interspersed the comments and questions throughout than just save them for the end, okay? Well, it's just my word for a force mediated by a new gauge boson. as I sort of mentioned. You don't like that? Okay, well, so maybe every time I say fifth force, you can think of new gauge boson. if that No, maybe I got a good one, I just didn't give a good answer, so, okay.
In your title, you mentioned the plural fifth forces. Did you do it on purpose, or?
Well, what I meant is that there are different kinds of possible fifth forces. And so I just meant to refer to the fact that some are what you might call dark forces, but some are not. So maybe that'll become more clear when I talk about what dark forces are. Okay, so yeah, thank you for the questions, and please keep them coming. Another obvious indication of new physics is the fact that we have this dark matter problem. I don't have to tell you that there are many reasons we believe in dark matter particles. All the evidence for dark matter is gravitational, and so perhaps it's in a hidden sector composed of particles with no standard model gauge interactions. So what I mean is a hidden sector is maybe including the dark matter particle X, but it might include other stuff. The only thing they have in common is that they don't interact with any of the standard model forces. This hidden sector has become more and more appreciated, may have a rich structure with matter and forces of its own. Okay, so you know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, the standard story was there are WIMPs, standard neutrinos, axions. This has become much more generalized as people have worked more and more on this, and is a definite trend that people are considering dark sectors as opposed to dark matter. And this has a very rich history, this idea of a hidden sector. Some people would say it goes even back to the original parity paper of Li and Yang, but a whole bunch of people have talked about this for decades, but it's really become a hot topic recently. Now, if that is the case, that there is a hidden sector, what can we learn about it? Well, astrophysics is sensitive to dark matter interactions. So astrophysicists certainly want to know what those interactions are, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a second. But as far as particle physicists and nuclear physicists go, what's really important is the dark matter standard model interaction. And so then one opens up this huge Pandora's box, because you can write down tons of different ways these sort of amorphous dark matter particles can interact with us. But there is an organizing principle, which Adam already referred to, which is we can think about effective operators and organize them by their dimensionality, right? So there are dimension 4 operators, 5, 6. Presumably the 5 and 6 ones are suppressed by some mass scale. And so if you just concentrate on the dimension 4 ones, there are not that many. So here, I've listed 3. The neutrino portal, which as we'll hear much more about here, includes the shell neutrino. The Higgs portal, which includes this quartic interaction of scalars and could be probed, for example, with exotic Higgs decays, invisible decays. And then there's this one, which is the vector portal, where you just couple the F mu nu of the standard model, U1, to the F mu nu of a presumably sort of dark electromagnetism. Now, for this talk about fifth forces, of course, we're mostly interested in this gauge boson coupling. So that vector portal has been explored at length, and there was some really seminal work by Holdum in 86. And the point is that you can take this operator, you realize it leads to kinetic mixing between the standard model and a hidden photon, and then you just sit down and you diagonalize that that new theory with this mixing in it to find the physical states. And the end result is you end up with a physical massless standard model photon, our neutral photon, and a massive dark photon, this A prime. You also find that the couplings of new, well, of all particles in principle shifts. So here I've drawn F to mean standard model particles, FH is hidden sector particles. So you can kind of think of it as an electron in the hidden sector, say. Now when you do this diagonalization, you find something very interesting. It's not quite symmetric. What happens is that the new gauge boson, the new dark photon, actually picks up a coupling to standard model particles. But the hidden particles don't pick up couplings to the standard photon. Okay. But what this means is that you now have a well-motivated new operator, a well-motivated new theory, which is basically giving you this new Feynman vertex. And you can start going around looking for ways you can be sensitive to that vertex. Okay. So this has generated a huge amount of work to just provide a little bit of sort of focusing of your attention. Let me note that this epsilon, so this was this kinetic mixing parameter which appeared at the front of that FF term. That's actually generated by diagrams like this, where you have a dark photon on one side, a normal photon on the other side, and a loop of particles that have both charges. Okay, so you can imagine that there is some particle, possibly very heavy, running in that loop, maybe many of them. And that will generate this epsilon parameter at the level of 10 to the minus 3 because it's a loop process. And so if you had to pick sort of your first order guess on what that epsilon parameter would be, you'd probably think it should be about a loop factor down 10 to the minus 3. As far as the mass of this A prime, this new force carrier goes, it really could be anything. But as I mentioned, its mass actually impacts astrophysical observables and dark matter. And so there is, as you probably know, a lot of interest in the so-called core versus cusp problem, dark matter distributions, whether cold dark matter is a good fit to the observed data. And it may be, this is still tentative, but it's very tantalizing, that the distributions are better fit by dark matter that has strong self-interactions. Basically, the dark matter should interact sort of like neutrons interact with a sort of barn cross-section if it's a GeV in mass. And so, as I say, this is tentative, a bit controversial, but if that were the case, you need to have dark matter interacting with a force carrier that's quite light to reproduce these sort of strong interactions, so maybe 1 to 100 MeV. So the bottom line of all this is that these considerations of dark matter motivate searches for a dark force mediated by dark photons, these A primes, which is a fifth force parameterized by two things, the mass of the force-carrying particle and the strength of the coupling. And perhaps there's this region of special interest where that mass is somewhere between 1 and 100 MeV, and that coupling is sort of 10 to the minus 3, that is, these things are giving you milli-charged particles. Okay, so that is the sort of theoretical framework. Now, this gained a lot of traction several years ago and has generated a ton of experimental activity worldwide. So basically, there's this plane, two-parameter plane, where here's the mass of this new particle, this new gauge carrier, gauge boson, and its coupling. This is E squared, so milli charges around here. And you can do an experiment and look for evidence of these new Feynman vertices. And there are a whole range of them. I can't get into them all right now, but in a nice sort of report from the Dark Sectors workshop that took place at Slack a few months ago, there's a nice cartoon picture, which I probably can go through. So up at the top, there are bump hunts. These are things like E plus E minus goes to, it could go to photon-photon, but you could replace one of the photons with a dark photon. Okay, so then the dark photon maybe decays to E plus E minus, so E plus E minus to photon E plus E minus. That kind of thing can be searched for at low energy, high intensity colliders. And so that sort of starts cutting into this parameter space from the top. Then there are beam dumps, C, here, where you have maybe an electron into a bunch of nuclei, and then you make electron nuclei plus this new particle, and you have some beam dump, so it has to get through a certain amount of distance before you can see it. And so that's probing low epsilons, low enough that the invisible, quote-unquote invisible particle can get through there before it decays. And so that starts eating away at the parameter space on the bottom. There's displaced vertices, where you look for very small vertices, decay lengths of maybe, smaller the better, but millimeters or centimeters, things like that, which can eat away sort of in the middle. But basically, this is kind of the game being played. Experiments are coming from the bottom, from the top. There's this thing in the middle, sometimes called Mott's gap, after Hugh Montgomery. And that's the cartoon. And this is sort of the state of the art from a whole variety of experiments. So these are beam dumps, some of them quite old. And these are you know, things like B plus C minus colliders, Babar, NA48 is very important, a CAN experiment looking for these dark photons in pion decays, and things like that. Okay. Yes?
The coupling of, let's say, electrons to the dark photon, is that parameter something you have to fine tune to be small, or is that actually small for some reason?
So in this scenario where you have a literal dark photon, it's just proportional to the electron's charge. So it's just it's the same sort of size as quark charges. So I probably should have done a better. Yeah, I should have mentioned this. For a dark photon, this new charge, the new vertex that's created here, is proportional to the standard model charge of the fermion, just with this, you know, suppression factor epsilon in front. But the electron, the up and down quarks, they're all exactly standard model-like except down by it. Oh, well, so it doesn't have to be, but if that epsilon were generated by a loop like this, then it's down by a loop factor, you know, 1 over 16 pi squared kind of thing. So that would probably be your first guess, but, you know, we should do searches trying to be ignoring that theoretical bias. Yes.
Is it common in these pictures that the stable dark matter is charged under this, or is it under this?
Mm-hmm. So okay, just to say something which I think is clear to you, but just to make it clear, the dark photon is almost certainly not the dark matter, but then in that dark sector, there are other particles, presumably, which would be the dark matter. And exactly what they are is sort of, you know, very model dependent, but it's a very nice thought to have that the dark matter might be stable because of charge conservation in the hidden sector. Right, so you would kind of like to think that it is charged under this this dark photon. Yeah. And that's one nice thing to get for free, as you know. Yeah. I mean, what I'm thinking about here is basically the dark matter is Rutherford scattering off of itself through an exchange of a dark photon. Yeah, so that's what I'm assuming there. Good, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, so like I say, there's a huge variety of experiments have been done, are being done, are being proposed. Okay, so I think that actually concludes what I'd like to say about dark forces and the motivation. Now I'd like to specialize to the particular relevance, especially given this setting, to nuclear physics. So we have now sort of some hints that there may be new physics at the MeV scale. Obviously, one thing one can do is look for that sort of thing in nuclear transitions, which are at the MeV scale. And this is not a new idea. After very shortly after axions came out, Treiman and Wilczek, Donnelly et al. Said, you know, if this is actually the case, that you have this MeV axion, you should be able to see it in nuclear transitions. And also a little later, some very nice work done by people who I think at least some of them are here. Brad's here. Yeah, but they tend to be down here somewhere. Yeah, that's right. Right. So, I mean, I've sort of pulled out the piece which I'm going to be most interested in for the second part of this talk. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of parameter space down here with all sorts of astrophysical constraints as well. Okay. Now this direction, I think, has special interest recently because there is a 6.8 sigma experimental anomaly reported by Krasner-Horke et al., which might indicate the production of new particles in excited beryllium-8 decays. And so this has set us, so us meaning collaboration here, including a number of postdocs at UCI, Susan Gardner, who's here, Tim Tate, and a graduate student of mine, has set us off in the direction of asking, could this experimental anomaly actually be evidence for these fifth force gauge bosons? Okay, so now I will start the part of my talk which I think I am most nervous about, because here I'm going to tell nuclear physics who actually people know about this, but I will just give me a chance to put this on the floor and you can tell me more about it. So the experimental result I'm referring to is by this Hungarian group, Krasna Horke, which came out a little over a year ago in Nuclear X, and then was published in PRL a few months, 8 months after that. What they did is they were looking at the excited beryllium 8 system. And so here is sort of the artist's conception of beryllium 8, the ground states here. And there are various excited states. The ones that they are most interested in are these 1 plus states here. There's a doublet. And they sort of at zeroth order have isospins here, but there's isospin mixing, which I will talk about. And they produce both of these and look for them to decay to the ground state in various ways. So how do they do this? Well, they take a very intense proton beam, hit thin lithium 7 targets, adjust the proton beam energy to be on resonance for making this BE star. So I'm using this sort of house notation, which I'm calling the BE star, the 18.15 MeV excited state BE star, and BE star prime, the 17.64. And so they make this 18.15 resonance, and then they watch it decay. Most of the time, it goes right back to proton lithium 7. Sometimes, with a branching ratio of about 10 to the minus 5, it decays electromagnetically, just to a photon. And then a special interest is when it decays through internal pair conversion. So basically, you make this BE star, and then it decays through E plus E minus production. And that's down by another factor of alpha from the electromagnetic decay. And what they've done is then looked at the directions of the E plus E minus, the opening angle, and also the invariant mass. And they find the following results. So here's the opening angle, theta. Here's just basically the number of events, the distribution. And what they find is that the background should have been a smooth monotonically falling distribution. And in fact, they see these data points here with incredible statistics, very small error bars you see there. And they do not fit a monotonically decreasing standard model prediction. And so they quantify that to be a probability that's a standard model fluctuation of 5.6 10 to the minus 12, 6.8 sigma effect. And they go further. They also postulate that what's being done is, in fact, you're actually producing a new particle. So that new particle is shown here as this X, which could possibly be heavy. Therefore, it would sort of be produced fairly slowly. Then decays E plus E minus with a big opening angle because it's slow. And that then gives this bump here. And they fit to various masses for that new particle X, and they find really remarkable agreement if that new particle has a mass of about 16.7 or 17 MeV. So they find that the chi-squared degree of freedom is 1.07 for this. Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Let's see. I think that one was the one with a cut on the energies. It's a symmetric requiring. So They have a large subsample, and then they consider various subsamples, including one where they cut on the asymmetry between the E plus E minus energies. And this one, I think, is showing, I'll say it, but this one shows that the excess is in the event sample with symmetric energies, which is what you'd expect for this X interpretation. OK, they also have some energy measurements for the E plus E minus, and so can construct an invariant mass of E plus E minus. And the invariant mass also is best fit by a mass for the X particle of about 17 MeV. Okay, so given the time, let me try to hurry through this a bit. But the signal is large in the sense that every bin that shows the excess has hundreds of events of an excess. Okay, so this is not a statistical fluctuation. It's obvious when you say it's a 6.8 sigma effect. Of course, that doesn't mean it's new physics. So clearly, all possible explanations should be pursued. Nuclear physics, maybe some experimental problem, but then also particle physics. Just a couple things. They have done some cross-checks. Obviously, they've thought about their data for years. This does not appear to be a last bin effect in the sense that it's a bump. It's not just a sort of smoothly rising excess. They have scanned through the proton resonance energies. And as you go through the resonance of producing the BE star state, the excess comes and goes. The excess is seen in the expected event samples. So when you do a cut, for example, on the asymmetry between the E minus and E plus energies, the excess is in the subsample you expect it to be in. And it's also in the events that pass this 18 MeV gate. And so it does not appear to be a result of sort of them decaying to an intermediate state on their way down to the ground state. One very important thing is that they do not see the excess in the 17.64 MeV decays. So they can also tune on resonance to that state. They don't see an excess. And our interpretation of that is very likely, if it's a particle, it has to be quite heavy so that this slightly lighter state is cut off from making that decay by phase space. Okay, so there are then clearly a number of interesting questions. What kinds, if this is a new particle, what kinds of neutral bosons are possible explanations of this? What are the parton level couplings? Because I'd like to be able to take that interpretation and ask, is it probed by anything else? And for that, I need to get down to the Quark couplings. Is it consistent with all the other experiments? As I mentioned to you, there's tens, maybe even hundreds of experiments probing this mass range. It's just 30 times heavier than an electron. So is it possible this could be right given all the world's other data? Is there an anomaly-free model that predicts this? Can I extend the standard model in a simple, beautiful way and accommodate this? And probably most critically, what other experiments can be done to check this? And so we worked on this. A number of other papers have also explored this. But it's clearly early days. Just quickly, there are reasons to think that it might not be a spin zero particle, for example, a dark Higgs, some have called it, just based on parity and angular momentum conservation. Let me not belabor that. For this talk, of course, I'm interested in the idea that maybe it's actually a new spin one gauge boson. And so what I would like to do here is push forward toward figuring out what the Quark couplings are. So one very nice thing about this experiment is one can use an effective field theory approach, because the energy of this putative new particle is low enough that it sort of should see the nucleus as a whole. So doing an effective field theory expansion, there's only one operator which I can have that has the right symmetries to characterize this. So the BE star is my excited state. The BE without anything is the ground state. The X alpha beta is the field strength of this new gauge boson. And because there's only one operator, I can take basically ratios like this of the production of an X boson, this new gauge boson, to the photon one. And if I assume first isospin is exact, then I only have, say, an isoscalar transition matrix element that contributes. And so I can figure out what this is going to be. And basically, because there's only one operator, the lambda scale and the matrix element cancel in the ratio. And so I can get fairly easily a constraint on the couplings of this gauge boson to the protons and neutrons, or assuming current conservation, to the up and down quarks. Okay? And so that's one very nice thing about gauge bosons. One can include isospin mixing. In fact, it is, I think, quite well established that there is isospin mixing in this system, in particular through recent work with Sari Pastor et al. And again, given time constraints, let me just say we've looked at this. And in principle, this can lead to large deviations in what one extracts for these couplings. But in the protophobic limit, where the proton coupling is small compared to the neutron one, this effect is quite small. So let me leave it at that. Okay, so what one can do then is say, okay, let me first think that this might be a dark photon because of all these motivations I talked about for dark photons, and ask, can that be consistent with everything? Turns out you need the up and down couplings to have some milli-charged number, which is good because we kind of had a theoretical bias for milli-charged. There's a constraint on the electron coupling, because when this X thing decays, it better not go too far before it decays, or it will sort of decay outside the detector. So there's a constraint there. But to get the right event rate, you need to basically be in this plane where the question marks are. And clearly, that is not allowed. That's about two orders of magnitude higher than the current constraints from NA48-2, for example. Okay, so basically, the first thing we figured out is that this can't be a dark photon. If you look in more detail at that constraint, it comes from pion decay. It comes from searches for pi zero goes to gamma x. However, if you are willing to generalize from the dark photon, you can actually eliminate this or suppress this by simply tuning the couplings of the up and down quarks of the X boson. So in the standard model, they're proportional to the standard model. In the dark photon case, they're proportional to the standard model couplings, and that doesn't work. But if you're willing to let them be in this relationship, or in other words, if they don't couple to the proton, like up there, then clearly that disappears. And so you can avoid. Let's see. Yeah, there are constraints from other mesons that you're not going to be able to avoid, but they're not constrained by the experiments as tightly. So these pions, for example, come from a very large number of kaons produced, which go to pi plus pi zero, and so you're not getting any eta's in there. There are interesting constraints from phis and other things that we do discuss. Okay, so I'm really out of time. Let me just say the following things. It turns out there are regions of parameter space that actually are consistent with every single other experiment on the market today. It requires that the gauge boson be protophobic. We've actually constructed models which give this in a fairly simple way. The gauge boson emerges as a U1 B minus L gauge boson, which has kinetic mixing to the photon. And basically, what happens is the gauge boson then has a B minus Q coupling. And if you just work through the B and the Q, you will find that that is going to give you a protophobic gauge boson. And so it's, I think for me, an astoundingly simple extension of the standard model will give you this particle. And you know, there's clearly more interesting work to be done. Future tests, maybe if someone can ask an appropriate question, I would love to hear your thoughts on that. But let me conclude. Fifth forces are motivated by some big, beautiful ideas in particle physics, the need for dark matter, force unification, and they have really excited a lot of people's interest in the last few years. Right now, there is a 6.8 sigma anomaly that has, as far as I know, no known nuclear or experimental explanation in beryllium 8 decays. And it's a beautifully fit to the particle interpretation, just in terms of fitting the spectrum. We have a proposal for what this is. It's a protophobic gauge boson that mediates a new fifth force. It also explains G minus 2 of the muon. And it could be a B minus L gauge boson. What clearly needs to be done now, of course, is to follow up with more experiments to either confirm or refute this, though. Thanks.
Microphones available here. Could you go back to the slide with the experimental evidence?
Okay.
So my question is, how well do we know the background, what you call the background model, the standard model, nuclear, coupled to nuclear physics, you know, those curves, how, what goes into those and how, what's the uncertainty?
Yeah, okay, so I'm no expert on these, but I guess these have been calculated, you know, decades ago by Rose et al., and I think they use those results. What they do is they fit to an M1 transition distribution plus some arbitrary floating E1, I guess, distribution. And because I think they think that could come from some production of another state, which, you know, has a very broad width, which is also being produced. And so the actual best fit is to M1 plus some amount of E1, and they find the best fit value of that is something like 20%. But that is considered by them to be the standard model background. I think what gives them some confidence that this is not going to be fit by background is that the M1, E1, all those different transitions are all monotonically falling. And so to the extent that this is an actual bump, which kind of looks like a bump to me, then, you know, it doesn't matter what percentage of these other things you put in there, you're not going to fit to it. You're not going to get a good fit.
Yeah, I was just wanted to comment about the 6.8 sigma, which sounds pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. However, it is, if I understand, it's a 6.8 sigma at that location. And so I would feel more comfortable if there was a reason to look there, but a priori, the theory doesn't tell you where to look. So in fact, the global significance is probably somewhat smaller. If you say, could it have been anywhere, what's the statistical significance? It would be somewhat smaller, I suspect.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I certainly agree, but it's not going to go below 5 sigma, right? I mean, there are only, I don't know how you do these look elsewhere effect calculations anyway, but you know, this bump is kind of broad. You could put it in various places, but there aren't that many places to put it. So I'm not sure how much of an effect that is. But I don't think it's going to take it down to like a 2 or 3 sigma effect.
I would say, when you're arguing about the difference between a 5 sigma effect and a 6.8 sigma effect, nobody cares about look elsewhere effects, which have to do with random fluctuations. It's clear enough that it's not random, but there's enough things to focus on about whether we believe it to be a boson or not. If it is a boson, what's that fits the model as fit? What's the vertex displacement and what's the width of the decay?
Ah, good. So the decay, I don't remember, but we can just figure this out on the fly. So the decay is just to, the dominant decay by far is just to E plus E minus. And the limit we would have got on that was a coupling of 10 to the minus 5. In the models we're getting, it's 10 to the minus 4 or 3. So basically, it's a tenth of a millimeter to 100 times smaller than that. Is the predictions that are coming out of it. In other words, just requiring it to decay within a centimeter gives you a certain limit, but that limit is superseded by other bounds on that electron coupling, which are tighter, and so it's actually much smaller than a centimeter by about a factor of 100 to 10,000.
So Jonathan, it's a very, very interesting talk. I was wondering, so what is special about the Brillouin-Mage system that makes this signal easier to see? I would have thought, it didn't seem very hard to see the bump. So why isn't it seen all the time? I'm trying to understand what's special.
Well, okay, so here there are clearly experts in the audience that know more than me. But the first thing I did is like, oh, Brillouin 8 sees this. Why don't we just look somewhere else? And so I go through this terrible thing that you guys have called the nuclear data tables. And I just, you know, spend 4 hours looking through this. And it's very hard to find transitions that are split by 18 MeV and that decay to a discrete photon. So actually, initially in my scan, I found none of them. Later on, some people told us, well, there actually are. And so I put them here. I don't know anything about these. Maybe some of you can tell me about them. But apparently, there are other transitions that have splittings bigger than 17 MeV, boron 10, beryllium 10. But of course, I have no idea how well one could use those to verify or refute this. But I think the simple answer is this is a very large splitting, and you don't see that almost anywhere in the nuclear tables.
John Donald.
let me just say, sorry, one last thing. In some ways, they've already done an extremely stringent test of their result, because they also did the 17.64 and didn't see it. So if you want to beat their null result, you have to find something that's bigger in energy splitting than the 17.64. Otherwise, it's superseded even by their null result.
So my basic understanding of how particles like this, like dark photons, evade various astrophysical bounds, really because the couplings are so large. So they're large enough. I mean, that epsilon of 10 to the minus 3 may look small, but astrophysically it's huge.
That's true, yeah.
So they stay in equilibrium. So for example, in the early universe, as the universe expands, the temperature drops, these things just have a Boltzmann factor that just cuts off their relic densities very, very quickly. Mm. But, you know, once you give me a mass, and you give me a mass of 18 MeV, that's a very interesting range, because if I think about what the plasma frequency for photons is in the early universe, for example, with a lot of electron-positron pairs around, it's roughly coincident with about 18 MeV at a temperature of order 10 MeV, roughly where the weak decoupling takes place, kind of the prelude to Big Bang nucleosynthesis. Mm-hmm. So I find that very intriguing, and I think if one worries, because the photons, the ordinary standard model photons, are actually not propagating in vacuum. They're propagating in medium. Hmm. And so they're effectively massive particles. And you can get things like mass level crossings with this thing that look very much like MSW, and you can resonantly produce these things.
I see.
So it's very rich. Uh-huh. But, I mean, you have to have a fairly large mixing to kill them off.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Susan, do you think there's any, or have you thought about any like precision effects that this might have?
Well, so one of the, we did look at a number of these. One of the, on the positive side, one thing people often talk about is the effect on G minus 2 of the electron and the muon. And so let me see if I can find that. Yeah, I didn't mention it, but I should. On this plot, you see a bunch of shaded-in regions, which are null results from various searches. But there's also some contours. So this blue contour is G minus 2 of the electron. And for this particle, so this particle can mediate G minus 2 of the electron. You just string a X boson across the fermion line, and it will generate a contribution of G minus 2 of the electron or the muon. And to have it not destroy results, the precision measurements of G minus 2 of the electron, you have to be below this blue line. G minus 2 of the muon, of course, is a little tricky because it actually has an anomaly of maybe 3.6 sigma or something. And to resolve that anomaly, you have to be within those black lines. So you have to have an effect, but not too much of an effect. And so there's actually a region that's preferred by G minus 2 of the muon. And so where it turns out we sit is right around here, 17 MeV, and it can go up to here. And so basically, there is a possibility of just barely resolving G minus 2 of the muon while not violating G minus 2 of the electron. So that's one immediate answer to that question. We have, you know, thought about all sorts of interesting things, looking for this thing brimming off of W boson decays, other mesons, as I mentioned. There are certainly constraints from those, but they're generally weaker than the ones I've actually included in these constraint plots.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the question of why it wasn't seen in other experiments.
Okay, good.
In fact, the internal pair conversion is sort of an unusual observable. In fact, we looked in this same system in beryllium-8, the same transition, but we were looking for another object, actually a 2 MeV object motivated from some old GSI data. And so in that case, the decay is small angle. And so the experiment is tuned to that. This experiment is actually has to be large angle because the energy, the mass is almost close to the transition. And so they're back to back. And we had no sensitivity to that. So it requires a very specialized experiment to look for such a thing.
Maybe this is actually a question for Brad, but it seemed to me that you're in a region where there's a very high level density, and so there are all kinds of background resonances that are nearby. Mm. So there should be interference effects. So are you saying that there can't be a bump that's induced by interference? you made the argument for simple E1s and simple M1s.
Just writing, adding them together.
What about multiple M1s that are interfering and higher multiples and so forth? It seems to me it's really complicated up in that region. But Fred, you've got the experience, so.
I haven't looked at it carefully, but certainly you can have interference that can cause that sort of thing in regular
So I'm, you know, well out of my comfort zone here, but one thing I remember in the paper is that they mentioned that that is partially addressed by looking at how big the excess is as you scan through the resonance. Because I think if it's an interference effect, you would not expect the effect to be maximal on resonance, but just a little off, right? And so the fact that the excess is maximized when you're on resonance as opposed to, you know, one width off is supposed to argue against that sort of interpretation, I think.
Well, it's really complicated. There's been four or five states around here that are interfering, all have different scales.
Okay.
It's pretty hard to make a generic argument that you couldn't produce a model.
Huh, okay. Well, it'd be wonderful if someone would put us out of our misery and find that nice nuclear explanation of this.
I just do another experiment. If someone who can do.
Okay.
Okay, well, there's plenty that we can discuss in the coffee hour, which is coming up right now then.